time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Stan Sorscher and Seldon Prentice. Stan Sorscher is president of the Washington Fair Trade Coalition and labor representative of the Society for Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace, also known as SPEA. Seldon Prentice is a facilitator of the Trade Policy Group at 350 Seattle and a senior lecturer at Seattle University, and they're both in to talk with us about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, also known as the TPP. Stan and Seldon, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
So this last Monday, the Seattle City Council joined Bellingham in voting unanimously opposing Trade Promotion Authority, also known as Fast Track consideration, of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. Can you tell us about the TPP and give us some history on that?
Sure. Most people are familiar with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement between Mexico, the United States, and Canada. TPP extends that from the three countries in NAFTA to 12 countries around the Pacific Ocean, including the three NAFTA countries. So if you think about what NAFTA does, it's a trade agreement. It has something to do with tariffs and quotas. But beyond that, NAFTA does much more. It also tells us how we're going to manage or govern trade. It says what rules the countries can have, and it also defines rights that investors have. So it really comes across in function much more as a governance document than a trade document. So I like to compare NAFTA with the three countries to the 50 states of the United States, right, that we merged our economies, particularly in 1789 when we wrote the Constitution. And the Constitution tells us how we manage trade among the 50 states, but also how we organize life among the 50 states. So the Constitution really expresses our values as a country. It's a moral, social, and political document, and it tells us how we're going to govern our society and our economy. NAFTA is also a moral, social, and political document, but very different, right? It expresses different values and has different interests. So the Constitution doesn't mention the word corporation once. And when you look at it, you know, particularly the Bill of Rights, it's all about individual rights. It's about separation of powers and checks and balances. It's really a very strong political document for governing. The NAFTA and now the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is in the same style, are also governance documents, but the priorities and the values expressed in NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership are mostly investor interests and the interests of global corporations. So Joseph Stiglitz, the economist who's held every important position in economics, he calls this, the way we manage globalization, global governance without a global government. Right, so he's very impressed by institutions, and we have a lot of institutions in the United States: the Supreme Court, our public education system, free press. I mean, there are a lot of institutions we have in the United States, and these are all part of the dynamic of how we govern. What are the institutions of globalization? They're mostly the three financial institutions: the IMF, the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and the World Bank. So that's the way he thinks about it, right? I think that's a very useful way of looking at the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's not a trade agreement. It's a governance agreement. There was an ambassador from Portugal who spoke in Seattle, and he was very, very excited about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and there's a corresponding agreement being negotiated with Europe. And he said, business will be very pleased with the way these agreements are coming out. And he said these agreements will determine how life is organized in 2050. And I thought, whoa, coming out of his mouth right after that other statement, that's a very provocative statement. But I think he's got a point, right? They're not the only things that are going to determine how life is organized in 2050, but this is the way we're going to express our values as a society into these documents. So that's kind of the way I think about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I say trade, but in my mind, it really is a much broader document. So it'll talk about what we can do for the environment, human rights and labor rights, public health, which, you know, is really access to medicines and health care, financial regulation, how we regulate the internet. Almost anything you think of as the responsibility of a legislature, Congress, a state legislature, or the Seattle City Council, all of this governance activity will then be done in the context of these other agreements. The TPP represents 40% of the global economy. Some big countries are in there, aside from the three NAFTA countries, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand. If you throw in the Atlantic Agreement with Europe, the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, you've really set global norms, right? This will establish, you know, the values and how we manage globalization pretty much for everybody as a global norm. So these two agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership right away and the Atlantic one in pretty soon, these are really very historic documents.
And who is actually crafting these rules? Is it elected officials?
No, it's really been crafted through the help of the trade ambassador, Froman, but with the help of 600 corporate advisors, roughly 600, and very few, maybe 10 members of civil society. So it's completely been dominated by corporations. And as you probably know, it's been negotiated in secret. So people have not had access. The members of the public certainly have not had access. And Congress has had minimal access. A year ago, if you called Senator Cantwell or your congressperson and asked about the TPP, they would not have seen it. They had not had access to it. More recently, some have been able to get access to the TPP through arranging special meetings. They have to go into a secret room. They can't take notes. It's horrific, really, when you think about that this is bypassed Congress. Basically, it's corporate. I mean, we talked about corporate governance, and that's why, because it's been written by corporations, basically.
The other day we were talking to Congressman Rick Larson, and he said he has looked at the text, and he has now read 80% of 20% or 80% of 25% of the thing. If you imagine this, reading the text, it's written in very technical language. And the USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative, always has somebody there when the elected official is looking at it, and they help interpret the text for them. So it's really remarkable. Just like Selden says, you have 600 corporate lobbyists who are actively engaged, have access to the documents, are communicating with each other in this national security-type forum, and advising our negotiators from the USTR's office. And at the same time, civil society and our elected officials are completely excluded. In the Seattle City Council debate, Shama Sawant made an interesting comment. It was electrifying because of her speaking style. But if you look at what she said, here are these large corporations actively involved in this. What are their interests? What are their values? What are their objectives? They're certainly not there to negotiate for workers or communities or the environment. What do you expect the outcome to be?
Yeah, it's been shocking, really, to think about.
Well, and as Stan, as you mentioned earlier, it's rights that investors have is, I think, a key line to what these documents are all about.
Yeah, and I can speak to that. NAFTA had these provisions, as have many other trade agreements. And they're called investor-state provisions. They're also known as ISDS, investor-state dispute settlement. But what this process is, and I, in many ways I think it's at the core of the TPP and other trade agreements, what these provisions do is they allow corporations whose country is part of the trade agreement, it allows these corporations to sue governments of other countries who are in the trade agreement and sue them when there's been a law passed that they believe harms their expected profits. Now, it's not exactly worded that way. The claims they make will be things like it violates the minimum standard of treatment or fair and equitable treatment, national treatment, or that it's the law that's been passed is in effect an expropriation. These are the kinds of claims they make. But when they demand damages pursuant to these claims, they're demanding their expected future profits. And this has happened under many trade agreements, including NAFTA. And it's really, in a sense, it's almost like a corporate veto power over local law. So it's very anti-sovereignty, which is why you do hear people on the right as well as on the left opposing these trade agreements because of this kind of provision. And if you're interested, I can give you some examples of some cases.
Yeah, please do.
Okay, so one that you often people hear about because it's fairly current is an American corporation, Lone Pine is the name of the company, sued the province of Quebec because Quebec had issued a moratorium on fracking. They were concerned about water pollution because, as you probably know, fracking has led to water pollution in a lot of areas. So they just wanted a moratorium on fracking. And as a result of that moratorium, Lone Pine, who had invested there, sued pursuant to NAFTA and demanded their lost profits. That case is pending, but there are others where the corporations have won. Another one also involving Canada was Ethel versus Canada, which led to a settlement. But Canada had banned MMT, which is a toxic gasoline additive. And it's banned by EPA, so we know it's a harmful substance. So Canada had banned MMT, and then Ethel Corporation sued as a result of that. And they reached a settlement, and Ethel Corporation received $13 million, and Canada reversed the ban. So it really is truly like a veto power. And it has a chilling effect as well. Because it allows because of this concern of being sued, many governments now stop and think before they pass these types of laws protecting our environment. And there have been stories of definitely American corporations calling Canadian officials and saying, you know, if you pass this, we're going to sue.
You know, I was talking to Adam Smith about this, congressman in Western Washington here. And he's very familiar with this, and he's been looking at this for a long time. And he made a funny comment. He said, you know, in America, it took us 200 years to sort all this out. So what Selden is talking about is, you know, what is the legitimate role of government in regulating for the public good? Who looks out for the public good? And I wasn't sure what Adam Smith meant by this, you know, it took us 200 years, but I went to Wikipedia and looked it up. And it turns out that there was a famous court case in 1905 where a bakery, objected to the state of New York setting a 10-hour day. So that's a labor law, right? And they said, who are you, the state of New York, to tell me, this bakery, what my hours of work are? And the Supreme Court looked at this and said, you know, this bakery is absolutely right. There's no legitimate role for government to be dictating to bakeries what their how many hours their employees should work. And that if that had been the way – if that had continued, America would have gone in some other direction, and there would have been very little role for government in regulating in the public good. And the private interest of businesses would have been given much higher priority than the public interest about labor rights or any of the other things we talk about. Well, then came the Depression and the discrediting of capitalism and the legitimate threat of communism. And a strong demand in, you know, of the public that Franklin Roosevelt do something about the Depression. Well, what he first did was try to pack the Supreme Court to get two more votes to overturn this 1905 decision. And the Supreme Court, being humans, looked at this and said, maybe we should go back and take another look at what is a legitimate role of government. And what came out of that, and this is like historic, you know, forces, right? What came out of that was they said, okay, here's the new standard. If a regulation is rational and serves the public good and is not a complete taking, right? This is the Fifth Amendment, says you can't have a taking without due process. If it's rational, serves the public good, and is not a complete taking, too bad for the bakery. Here it comes, right? There's going to be regulation. So that I think that's what Adam Smith was talking about. We actually resolve this with our, you know, democratic political whatever process. Investors and corporate lawyers never gave that up. They never accepted that defeat. And now here come the trade agreements, and they get a clean sheet of paper, and they say, let's rewrite this. Why should we accept that standard? So the new standard, what Selden is talking about, is if you have a new regulation, something that comes along and all that funny language, you have to you can do whatever you want to regulate in the public good. That's what they say, as long as you compensate us for our loss of expected future profits. So they have this new standard. They have their own corporate-friendly private courts, and they have a new remedy, expected future profits. So the trade agreements have really given the advantage to investors. That's the investor right and the investor privilege that comes out of these agreements.
And we should mention more about those trade courts and also that concept of taking that you mentioned. But as to the trade courts, yeah, they're so these lawsuits don't take place in Canadian courts or U.S. courts. They're really arbitration panels with three corporate lawyers who revolve, you know, some of the time they're actually handling these cases and other times they're serving on these tribunals. For a long time, they were secret. I've noticed in new language, supposedly they won't be secret if the TPP comes through. But that's little comfort for the fact that they are trade tribunals. There's no sense of precedent, no appeal process. So these corporate lawyers really have their say. And back to the concept that Stan mentioned of taking, it's a very interesting concept because, yes, under U.S. law, a corporation will only have a claim for a taking if it's fairly extreme. In other words, government regulation alone is not a taking. But through this this trade court process, they can claim, they're basically saying, requiring me to get this certain permit that has standards maybe beyond what I was expecting, that's a taking. I get to sue you for that, and you owe me. So these trade courts, these provisions for suing for expropriation started back when we were actually encouraging corporations to go overseas and build a factory, and this was the idea was this would help develop less developed countries. And so there was this idea that if corporations did that, they needed to be protected from expropriation. They needed to be protected from the government of that country taking their factory. So that was really the reasoning behind this originally. And then it's just expanded enormously into this idea that when you regulate me, when you make me clean up, I mean, there have been cases in Central America where corporations have been asked to clean up a toxic area where they've been mining, for example. And when they're having to clean up more than they expected, they say that's a taking. That's an expropriation. You owe me money. It's as though these decent concepts where they started have just ballooned into outrageous claims.
Yeah, you know, we talk about this in public groups, and you can see the looks on people's faces.
Yeah.
And when we have these conversations, the look is they wouldn't really do that, would they? And that's kind of the sense, you know, that that Selden was telling that story that, well, we meant, you know, these communist countries are going to take our property. but if you look at some of these cases, regulating cigarette smoking in Australia, yeah, that's a public health issue. The cigarette companies are asking for loss of future profits. When Germany decided to close down their nuclear power industry, Sweden, there was a Swedish country that says, wait, I was going to make a lot of money on that. You owe that to me. As you see more and more of these, country of origin labeling, don't you think we should know where our meat comes from? No, it's not WTO compliant, right? That's a taking. So, you know, Selden mentioned that we think of how our courts work, and that becomes our starting point. It's important to remember these tribunals don't pay any attention to the U.S. Constitution or the Canadian Constitution or the Australian Constitution or the legal traditions of Germany. They make their decisions based on the trade agreements and the priorities and the rights and the interests and the values in the trade agreements. That's all they look at. And you would think that if you were worried about fracking in Quebec, you would go to the provincial government in Quebec, and then you would go to the federal government in Ottawa, and you'd go to the Supreme Court or whatever they have in Canada. Don't bother. In fact, this Lone Pine Company was a Canadian company. They could have gone through the legal process in Canada. They knew they would get nothing because that's not Canada's legal tradition. So they had an operation in Delaware, and they let the Delaware operation sue Canada under NAFTA. And you see this quite frequently. The Philip Morris in Australia went through the entire Australian legal process to fight plain paper packaging of cigarettes. They lost. The High Court said, no, that's a legitimate regulation under our legal tradition. So Philip Morris found a trade agreement between Australia and Hong Kong. They opened up an operation in Hong Kong. And 9 months later, this Hong Kong operation is suing Australia.
And that's pending still. But it's so outrageous. The idea that Australia is not allowed to make a decision for its own people about the safety of cigarettes and how they are labeled. And there's a similar – Philip Morris has also sued in another country. I've forgotten.
Uruguay. And they intimidated Togo.
Same concept.
You know, there's a great John Oliver video.
A spinoff
from The Daily Show. And he talks about this. Go YouTube, Google John Oliver Tobacco Companies. This is 18 minutes of
hilarity.
He really hits this one out of the park. It's so outrageous. So that does answer the question, would they do that? Yes, they would do that.
And, you know, you often hear when you're debating someone who supports the TPP, they'll say, oh, but the U.S. has never lost one of these cases. So, you know, we have nothing to worry about. And first of all, there have been cases where we almost lost, and the only reason we didn't was some technical procedural rule saved the U.S. But with the expansion of the number of corporations who would have access to these ISDS trade provisions with the TPP, things will change dramatically. And the numbers of these cases have already been increasing over the last few years from where it used to be. I think in the first 30 years of these trade agreements, there were maybe 50 cases or something. And just in the last few years, there have been 50 per year. And with the TPP, it would just be an astronomical increase. And you'd have many more wealthy corporations entering into this trade system than we have right now. And I mean, that's why we've been lucky. Most of these suits have been American corporations suing other countries. And that also gets me when they say, oh, well, we've never lost. Well, do you not have compassion for these other countries who have lost, who've not been able to regulate their environment because of American corporate greed? It's just amazing. The one other comment I want to make about ISDS cases, really, you know what this is? It's free insurance for these corporations. Corporations normally have to obtain insurance for their risk. And this is giving them free insurance, except it's not really free. It's the taxpayers paying it.
Right. And in our democracy, we're paying for their insurance with our democracy. You know, Seldon brings this point up. It's a U.S. Trade Representative's talking point. We've never lost a case. We've never lost a case in one particular venue. That's the investor state. We have lost at least four cases.
In the WTO, right?
There's something called state-to-state cases, and it uses exactly the same logic and exactly the same legal principles. I mentioned country of origin labeling. That's a case we lost. We lost a case about clove cigarettes, which I'd never heard of, but they appeal to children, and we regulated clove cigarettes, and Indonesia has a clove industry. And they said, wait a minute, you know, you've reduced the value of our investment. We lost a case on internet gambling where we just settled. We were going to regulate internet gambling in some, I don't know where this was in the Caribbean, some internet gambling thing. We lost that. And the tuna fish case was again, as Selden said, on technical grounds, it was limited to a very small fishing region around Mexico. We decided, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, you know, we wanted to do something nice to dolphins. The Mexican fishing industry said, well, you're differentiating on a performance condition. Tuna fish is tuna fish. Cookie is a cookie. Dog food is dog food. You can't differentiate on the way the dog... If I made my cookie with slave labor, tough for you, right? That's, you can only make distinctions on the product, not the...
how it was created.
How it was created. So, okay, so we can't have tuna fish labeling, dolphin safe.
Dolphin safe, yeah.
So then we said, let's have voluntary labeling. If you want to, you can use it as branding. Back to the WTO, and we lost that one twice. Again, it's only for this one narrow, technically defined fishing ground. So my tuna fish still says dolphin safe. But the principle is there. This kind of tells you how they think, how the language in the trade agreements is very, very different from our legal traditions, and the values in the trade agreements are very different from our values.
So this, the fast track authority for the TPP is coming up very soon in Congress and the Senate. Can you briefly talk about that?
So fast track is, we talked about the trade agreements and how they operate. Fast track is a procedural legislation starting with Nixon. And the idea is that you've negotiated this very complicated piece of legislation, and why let Congress fool with it? So fast track says there will be an expedited congressional procedure, very limited debate, no amendments, an up or down vote, and a short timeline. So it's a way of kind of packaging up this deal, wrapping it up in protective coating, and shooting it through Congress with as little public engagement as possible. Now, financial regulation is pretty complicated. We manage that. Healthcare is pretty complicated. We manage that. We've had lots of trade agreements in the past without fast track. But what fast track does is take this secretive process with no political awareness or public engagement that was negotiated for 5 years and shoot it right through Congress. We think fast track legislation will be introduced April 20th. The fight will be in the House. The Senate will probably approve anything. But in the House, there are 151 Democrats and maybe 40 Republicans. So that's close to – it's going to be a good fight in the House, which means that – and Washington State has 5 Democrats who have not taken a strong position, a public position. So Adam Smith, Derek Kilmer, Denny Heck, Susan DelBene, and Rick Larson – if those are your elected officials, you should call them.
Call all of them.
Just
call all of them. And let me, I want to make sure we get the phone number in, and then Stan, you can finish your thought. But there are 2 phone numbers you can try. There's the Congressional Switchboard, which is 202-225-3121. I'll say that again, 202-225-3121. Or you can try 888-804-8311, 888-804-8311, and they'll direct you to the congressperson you want to reach.
My favorite is the Congressional Switchboard, the 202 number. I've called that, and these receptionists just have such great voices, and they're so reassuring, and it's so easy to do. Another thing is you can just drop in your elected official's office. That's actually a lot of fun. Go to town hall meetings. Any chance you have to communicate with your elected officials, let them know.
In the next week.
In the next week, right.
This week.
Yeah, this coming week.
All right. With that, we are unfortunately out of time. I've been talking with Stan Sorcher, president of the Washington Fair Trade Coalition, and Selden Prentice, facilitator of the Trade Policy Group at 350seattle.org. And quickly, both of your websites, if people want to get more information.
www.washingtonfairtrade, all one word, washingtonfairtrade.org.
And 350seattle.org. You can find us.
And we're on Facebook, too. Washington space Fairtrade, one word, Fairtrade.
All right.
And we're on Facebook, too. Thanks.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks,
Mike.
Thank you.